Good morning. I must tell you again how pleased I am for the invitation to be here with you and to celebrate this special Lord's Day. My wife and I are grateful for the fellowship and friendship of you folks, your pastor and his family, and the hospitality of the Atkins again. It's so good to see you and to share this time with you. And I appreciate so much your being here. The pastor's parents have a special place in our hearts. I remember them from more years ago than is any of your business. And I appreciate them and what the Lord has done in sparing them for so long. I was met by someone this morning who said, "I expected you were going to grow a beard in order to come and be Charles Spurgeon." You can tell from the pictures in the bulletin insert that I don't look anything like him. I'm not going to sound like him. I'm not going to try to be him. I'm just going to ask you to imagine that I am Charles Spurgeon. I want to tell you the story of his life, as if I were he. My name is Spurgeon. The word seems to come from a Dutch word that means sparrow. Sparrows are plentiful and not very valuable. We came from Holland, the time of the Reformation, the 16th century. The King of Spain sent the Duke of Alva to the Netherlands, ruled by Spain then, to persecute Christians, Bible believers, Protestants. And we, my family, fled to England, to Essex County, and took residence in the town of Kelvedon. My great-grandfather's grandfather, you can count that number of generations, was Job Spurgeon. He was a preacher. He was imprisoned in the Netherlands for the same reason that John Bunyan was imprisoned. It was Chelmsford Jail in England. Bunyan, of course, in Bedford Jail. For the same reason, that was preaching the gospel without the authorization of the church. And I said once I was more proud that there flowed in my veins the blood of one who had been imprisoned for the gospel's sake than if there had been in those veins the blood of emperors or kings. Job Spurgeon. My grandfather, James Spurgeon, was a preacher. My father, John Spurgeon, was a preacher. I had had preaching in my patrimony for centuries. My grandfather, James, had been pastor for 54 years of the same congregation. 39 is getting there. 54 years, Stambourne Meeting House. In fact, that congregation had had a total of 4 pastors in 200 years. My grandfather, I came to know him very well because very early in my family's life, I was sent to live with my grandparents. I was the first of 17 children in my parents' family. Now, before you marvel at that, be reminded that childhood mortality was a very common issue in my time. Children died in infancy and in childhood, and they followed one another to the grave. Of these 17, only 2 boys and 6 girls lived to be adults. Imagine, parents, the continual reminder of pain from marching to burial grounds. six girls, two boys. I'll let you pause to consider which is the weaker sex. I was one of these two boys. I was the first of the family. My parents, my father was a pastor of a congregational church in Calvedon, and very early after I was born, there was difficulty, and the family moved to Colchester, another town not far away. And I was sent at the age of two to live with my grandparents. I was not rejected from my parents' home, but to make room for those who were following me. And with the difficulty and the sparseness of provision in my father's family. So I was reared for the next 6 years until I was 8 years old in my grandparents' home. I had regular contact with my parents on occasion, but I lived with them and their unmarried daughter, Anne, Aunt Anne. Aunt Anne, my father's sister, taught me my letters, taught me the rudiments of learning before ever I had any schooling. And I lived with daily prayers and preaching. Grandfather loved his congregation. They loved him, obviously, carrying on with him for so many decades. Grandfather had the practice of praying before meal, thanking the Lord for what we were about to receive, and then praying after the same meal with thanksgiving for what we had just received. I don't know whether anybody still does that. And in this post-meal prayer, he would regularly pray by name for members of his congregation, for those in special needs, and for those who had slidden back into the world. He wept over them as he prayed for them. The compassion of my grandfather pushed dearly into my soul. One of them in particular was Old Rhodes, R-O-A-D-S. I never knew his first name. Old Rhodes. Grandfather would pray and weep over Old Rhodes. Old Rhodes had been a member of his congregation, had come to know the Lord Jesus, had regularly continued to go into the tavern and drink with his former friends. And this brought tears to my grandfather. One day, as a child, regretting the recurring tears of my grandfather for Old Rhodes, I announced to my grandparents, "Someday I'm going to kill Old Rhodes so grandfather won't weep anymore." Now, they didn't know what that meant, and it was not a right thing to say, and they dismissed it until one time grandmother sent me into the town. I'm a child. I'm 4 or 5 or 6 years old. On an errand in the country store. And I looked into the window of the tavern, and I saw Old Rhodes cavorting with his friends and drinking, and yet he was one of grandfather's church members. And I did something no young man or older either should do. I went into that tavern, and I walked up to Old Rhodes, and pointing my childhood finger in his face, I said, "What doest thou here, Elijah?" Now, his name was not Elijah, but I had heard Grandfather preach on that text, and I thought it was appropriate for Old Rhodes. And I said, "Grandfather weeps over you, Old Rhodes." And I left, fearful of what he might reply. And I went home and I announced at mealtime, "Grandfather, today I killed old Rhodes." Grandfather didn't know what that meant. And in some consternation, until there came the sound of a step on Grandfather's porch, and old Rhodes came back weeping, confessing his sin and asking forgiveness and saying, "I don't want my pastor to weep over me." And a child had been used of God. Before I ever knew the Savior of my soul, I say Aunt Anne had taught me my lessons, and I discovered in the second story of Grandfather's house a number of Puritan volumes, heavy tomes. They were heavy in both respects, and I would drag them down the steps, couldn't carry them, and open them in front of the fireplace, and on my tummy I would turn the pages and imagined I was reading them. And soon began to read them. And I became married to those Puritan preachers before I ever knew the God of whom they preached. Grandmother always sat in her rocking chair with a Bible open on her lap as she read and prayed. One Lord's Day, Grandmother was not feeling well. She sat in her rocking chair with her Bible open. We had to leave her at home and didn't take her to church. We returned from the service and saw Grandmother still in the rocking chair with the Bible still open on her lap. And it was open to that text, "The hand of the Lord hath touched me." And we buried Grandmother with much weeping. And soon I became 8 years old. And my parents decided to bring me back home. And I was reluctant to leave. I had been dearly attached to my grandparents and Aunt Anne. Grandfather sensed this reluctance, and he said to me, "Charlie." Now, not many people called me Charlie. "Charlie, look at that moon," he said. "That moon will be our touchstone. Remember, every time you look at the moon, remember that Grandfather is looking at the same moon. And so we won't be far away from each other." I went back to my home and became acquainted now with children and had children to play with. And the only kind of playing I knew was imitating church. So we played church. This was not sacrilegious or irreverent. This was serious. I was the pastor, I was the preacher, I was the song leader, and my siblings were the congregation, and I insisted that they pay attention, stay awake, and don't disturb anybody. And we had church. And time was passing. Back in my parents' home, I had the opportunity of attending a home school. Mrs. Cook's home became a schoolroom for members of the neighborhood whose parents would pay a modest sum to her. Mrs. Cook, this was my first formal education. I was not to have very much, but I had to buy, Mrs. Cook insisted, a slate pencil to use in practicing letters and numbers and calculations. And I did not want to ask my indigent father for the money. And I heard from one of my friends that if I went to the general store, the storekeeper would give me a slate pencil with my signature on a promissory note to pay in the future. Ah, wonderful, I did it. I got my pencil. I came home and proudly explained to my parents what I had done. My father was not pleased. He marched me quite literally down to the store. He paid my debt and he tore the note. And then he lectured me all the way home. And he said, son, there are three things you must remember in life. Three things you must avoid: the devil, dirt, and debt. And that lesson, as a child, struck dear and near and was remembered for years to come. I would not open the newly constructed tabernacle, for example, on the day it was scheduled, until in the afternoon of that day, the last amount required to pay for the building was received. I do not comment on your contemporary concept and the appropriateness of borrowing and so forth. But for me, in my time, God was going to supply before we had to have it. I learned a little bit more from Mrs. Cook's school, but then I became a budding teenager, and I began to be more personally concerned with the message of the gospel, which I had heard from my earliest days. I knew the scriptures. I knew preaching. I knew all about, but I did not know him whom to know aright is life eternal. And I had a increasing longing in my soul for the satisfaction of my heart. I pled, I prayed, I worked, I wondered, I examined, and I wasn't sure whether the Bible were the only truth, and maybe some other religion. And I went to various churches, and I had the practice of going around and listening to, and I discovered that preachers would tell me either the joys awaiting the redeemed or the pain awaiting the damned. But no one made clear to me how I could go from the status of a sinner to the joys of salvation. And I determined then, though it seemed a far remote possibility, that if ever I should preach, I would always be sure that those who heard knew from my preaching how to become a citizen of heaven. When I was there with my grandparents earlier, a missionary had come for a weekend, and he stayed in the parsonage, and he took an interest in me, and he said, I feel that someday you, young man, will preach to thousands. And when you do, he said, he didn't say if you do, when you do, I want the first hymn you announce to be, God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. And that proved to be the case in the beginning of the Metropolitan Tabernacle that was to come. But now, I'm going to various churches, and I'm listening, and on a particular day, I'm 15 and a half years old. It's January of 1850. I was born in 1834, in the middle of the year, in June. I was on my way to a particular church, but it was a snowy Sunday morning, and I could not arrive at the church I intended to attend. Neither could the pastor, as it turned out. He was snowed in. So I went down a side street, and I, on Artillery Street, came to the Primitive Methodist Church. Now, I had been warned about the Primitive Methodist Church. I was told that they sang so loudly that your ears would ache. Well, on this day, I was more concerned with a heartache than with an earache. And I went into this church. Hardly 10 or 12 people had arrived by the time the service was to begin, not including the pastor. And there was an embarrassed silence when the time of the service passed. And a few minutes later, a tall, lanky layman, a steward, I guess, of the Methodist Church, went up into the pulpit, and he opened the Bible in the pulpit, and he chose a text, and he began to, well, I can't say he preached. He read the text. And it was from Isaiah 45, verse 22. Look unto me, and be ye saved, all ye ends of the earth, for I am God, and there is none else. And then, not knowing what to do next, he read the text again and hoped for an inspiration as to what to say next. And then he said simply, well, now this is a simple text. All it says is look. Now, it's not hard to look. Anybody can look. And then it says look to Jesus. Well, it didn't say that exactly, but he was on the right track. Don't look to yourself, he said. There's no help there. Don't look to the Father. Look to him by and by. Look to Jesus. And then he spied me under the balcony, under the gallery. I had taken a seat there, not willing to be noticed. And yet so few were present that anyone present was noticed. And he looked at me and he pointed to me and he said, young man, you look miserable. Well, it was true, but I didn't expect him to publicly point me out. And you'll continue to be miserable until you look to Jesus. And then he said, young man, look. Look! And then, like a Methodist steward, he said, look. Look at Jesus hanging on the cross. Look at me bleeding for your sins. Look at me rising from the tomb. Look at me. And I, who had been willing to do 50 things, could have looked my eyes away. And I came to Jesus as I was, weary and worn and sad. I found in him a resting place, and he has made me glad. I was so glad I went out of that congregation into the snows, and I could have preached to the birds if there were any. I was so rejoicing in the peace that flooded my soul. And now what had been head knowledge from my earliest remembrance became heart experience. And God began a work in a little boy now 15 and a half years old. And I began to share simply what God had done for me in Sunday schools, in handing out gospel folders, in speaking to people gathered in farmhouses, anywhere I could. I was simply telling what Christ had done for me. I'm a boy, I say, was invited to speak at Sunday school convention and gave my testimony. Didn't know it was a sermon, it was my testimony. And there were those who heard. And when I heard of a lady who came to know Christ, having heard my testimony, I was more rejoicing than if I had been a diver who came up with a priceless pearl from the sea. God was using a teenage boy. He had given me a voice. He gave me now a heart filled with the desire to bring him glory. And I proceeded now. In the Sunday school convention, there was a man, Mr. Gould was his name, who had a friend in London who was a member of a pulpit committee for a congregation which in former years, centuries, had had a series of godly Puritan preachers, among them John Gill, Benjamin Keach, John Rippon, who for decades had been pastors of this new Park Street Congregational Church in London, and now were without a pastor. The congregation had dwindled from 1,200 to fewer than 300. And I say this, Mr. Gould had a friend in London, told him that he ought to consider inviting this young Spurgeon boy to candidate for the pastorate. By the time I was 17, I had become the pastor of a little congregation in the town of Waterbeach, which described the town. A small congregation. I was 17 by then. They were too small to support a full-time pastor, so they arranged that I would live in the home of a different family in the church each week. They would provide my room and board. I needed little else. And members of the congregation would provide foodstuffs and vegetables and so forth to help out. And I was enjoying this, and the Lord was prospering. And then on a certain Lord's Day, I received a letter from this member of the church in London, which I was sure was misaddressed and not intended for me. I was no London preacher, and I knew it. If I had no education beyond Aunt Anne and Mrs. Cook's school, my family had moved, I say, to Colchester, and I attended a little school in the town of Newmarket, where a distant relative was the teacher, one teacher. I had the equivalent by then of maybe the first couple of years of a high school education. My father said, if you're going to be a preacher, son, you need an education. Now, in those days, you didn't just write for an application to a college and fill it out and send it in. No, instead, you arranged for a personal interview with a member of the faculty of the institution. And this interview was the basis of a decision about your admission. It was arranged that Dr. Angus would meet me at the home of the Macmillans in the town of Cambridge. Macmillan, the family of the publishing company, as well as in the 20th century, I guess, in your time, the Prime Minister of Parliament. The Macmillan, the most important house in the city of Cambridge. I was never at the University of Cambridge, you understand. On a certain day, I was to meet at a certain time this Dr. Angus. I arrived on time, a little bit early, not wanting to lose my opportunity, and was ushered into a room of the house, the palatial house, by a maid who promptly forgot I was in the house. When the Dr. Angus arrived, he was ushered into a different room of the same house. Each of us waited for the other, ignorant of the fact that both were in the house in different rooms. The time passed. The professor had to leave for another appointment. Then the stupid maid was reminded that I was in the house. I was downcast with despair. My opportunity had been lost. A day or two later, it was no audible voice, but a voice of the Spirit of God spoke to me, saying in the words of Jeremiah, "Seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not." I was to have no formal education beyond the first 2 years of high school, but God gave me the ability to read, the ability to remember what I had read, the ability to read rapidly. God enabled me to glean from the writings of hundreds the knowledge preserved over centuries, and it was evident that whatever of human success I was to enjoy was not the product of formal education, but of an education in the Spirit, by the Spirit, for the glory of the Father. I was sure, I say, that this letter from London had been a mistake, but in fact it was not. I replied, saying, "I'm sure this was addressed to someone else, but I'm both honored and amazed that it came to me." And a letter was sent back saying, "No, it was not an error. We do want you to come." It was agreed that on a certain day I would come. I arrived on the Saturday prior, was directed to a boarding house. In the letter, it was arranged that I would stay at a certain boarding house Saturday night and then preach on the Lord's Day. I was received with great ridicule in the boarding house. Other young men there looked at me and discovered that I was coming to preach in London, and they laughed at me. "You're no London preacher." I had the practice of using a handkerchief with bright blue polka dots on it, and I would regularly punctuate my points, 1, 2, 3, with a shake of the... This was corny. This was not pulpit manners. It was not London preaching. I was not dressed properly for a London preacher in a frock coat and all the accoutrements. They laughed at me, and it was trepidation that I enjoyed that night, not sleep, as I waited for the Sunday morning. I preached, and people came to hear and were amazed at what they heard, and then talked about it all afternoon to their friends, so that more people came when I spoke Sunday night, out of curiosity to hear this country bumpkin preach in this staid Puritan pulpit. I was asked to come back I was asked to come finally for a 6-month trial. And I said, no, 3 months will be more than long enough for you to decide. At the end of the first month, I was offered a permanent pastorate. It was with hesitation, but with submission to what seemed to be the will of God, that I came to preach in London. Among those who had come to hear this country bumpkin was a young lady. Susanna Thompson was her name. She was everything that I was not. She was cultured, refined, educated, gentle, and you're guessing correctly that a process had begun. On her 21st birthday, I gave Susanna a gift, a birthday gift, in the opening flyleaf of which, this copy of Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, I inscribed the words to Susanna Thompson from C.H. Spurgeon, with much interest in the progress of your pilgrimage. And as you have imagined, we were married eventually, and she became God's greatest gift to this poor preacher. She became the mother of our only children, twin boys, both of whom eventually became preachers. A few years later, she became confined to her bedroom with illness. She became an invalid. But she was to conduct a ministry, not only of prayer, from her bedroom, a ministry that sent books, copies of her husband's sermons, and his lectures to pastors anywhere in the world whose address she could discover. She had a book ministry that touched continents for Christ. Without regard to denomination or position, country preachers, big city preachers, all had opportunity to share in Susanna's ministry. I called her Susie. She called me Tirshatha, which is an Old Testament title for honor often given to a sovereign. It was our endearment to each other. The church prospered. The preaching of the gospel in the city of London saw results that London had not seen for decades. It was not flash or profundity. It was simply the saving gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. And that vow of a boy that if I were ever to preach, I would be sure to show men how to be saved every time I did was carried out daily. Eventually, I preached about 8 times a week. I was invited to neighboring towns and would go and would preach. And God used it everywhere. And it was such a strange phenomenon at this time in London where sermons had become theological treatises which put people to sleep. One lady who had insomnia said, I can't sleep at night except when I'm in church. That's the only time I can sleep. The sermons are so dull. And now God was blessing the proclamation of his word with power. God had given me in my youth contact with simple people and with ordinary folk, and I could speak the language of the plowman, as it were, and were able to relate to the needs of the common people. And hundreds came, and soon thousands came. And of course, competition to other preachers who resented this country bumpkin, and people were running after him so greatly in numbers that the police had to cordon off streets in advance of the hour of service. It was so crowded that you had to come a half hour early to get into the building. And then people gathered on the street outside the building through open windows here, hoping to hear. Horse-drawn carriages were the means of transportation. And police had to protect women who were often trampled in the eagerness to come into the building. 90% of the congregation soon were men, and among them were the Lord Mayor of London and the Chief of Police, and prostitutes and thieves. And I cared not who came, so long as all who came heard the saving truth of the gospel. God prospered. God saw, and soon the building, which was designed for 1,200, could no longer hold the number that were coming. And in the midst of a sermon on the walls of Jericho coming tumbling down, I suddenly said, they prayed and the walls came down, and if we pray, this wall will come down. And I was announcing an expansion of the building in the midst of a sermon, without any prior, they proceeded to do it, and soon it was proved to be unwise. The building was too small, having been expanded for the crowds that were coming. In the meantime, we met in the Exeter Music Hall, a public auditorium in the city of London, which was not used on the Lord's Day, so we rented it. It held 5,000 people, and it was filled. And then after a while, it was not possible for us to use it anymore because they began to schedule events in it on Sunday, and we had to move. But on my 21st birthday, a young woman in the congregation gave me a small gift of money with a note attached saying it was to be used as the first contribution toward the building of a new building appropriately large for our needs. And thus began the announcement of a building program. In 1859, a cornerstone was laid, and we prayed that none would be hurt in the building of a building to hold 5,000 people on the main and gallery floors, a building with a thrust pulpit area that was above the level of the first floor and slightly below the level of the balcony, with a seat for 1,000 in another room on the basement floor. And this was surely more than big enough. While it was being built, we moved to the Royal Surrey Gardens Hall, which seated 10,000 people, and it was soon filled. And then occurred an event which was to bring upon me a season of despair. It was a Sunday night. The building was crowded with 10,000 people on the main and gallery floors. And I was ready to announce my text when suddenly there appeared, as pre-planned by ruffians, the shouts of fire, fire! There was no fire except in the pulpit preaching, but no one knew that. And everybody sought to exit this building with no regard for one another. People were trampled. When it was over, 128 people had been injured, 27 had been hospitalized, and 7 people were dead. And the papers flooded scorn and blame on Charlie Spurgeon. Whoever would think of bringing that many people together in a building like that for preaching? I was to blame for what ruffians and ne'er-do-wells had done, and I could not preach. I had, among other maladies, gout, extreme pain in the limbs and joints, which was aggravated by exercise and yet was relieved by exercise, and that combination was extremely troubling. The cold and damp weather of London drove me repeatedly to southern France on doctor's orders for recovery. And typically in the fall of the year, I would have to go for a month or 6 weeks to southern France on the shore of the Mediterranean just for the sunshine. It was not vacation. The hotelier had me present devotions in the lobby each morning, and it was a time for physical restoration. The sun helped to undo the work of the dampness in the limbs of the gout. I had been, by a doctor's orders, sent on frequently to this. But this time I stayed longer and I could not preach. I was in despair and God was working in me until finally I returned and the building was dedicated. It was opened. The Metropolitan Tabernacle didn't look like a church building. It was not intended to have a spire and churchy Gothic architecture. It was a rounded dome. It was pillars in the front. It was an auditorium. It was a hearing place. That's all. It was the Metropolitan Tabernacle. It has since been burned twice in the 20th century and rebuilt on a smaller scale. Still functioning today, by the way, as some of you know, with a good pastor and with several hundred people present in the basement room on a Wednesday night prayer meeting. A good testimony still. An international congregation of business people and students who come to London for various reasons and don't stay long and then go back to their respective countries as missionaries, and the pastor has said how transient is his congregation, and yet what an opportunity they have. But I digress. The church prospered, the people grew, and the message grew, and the time passed, and the time is passing. And I saw the need for other ministries in this major city. Urchins on the street, boys unprovided for, an orphanage for boys, and God provided the means for it, and soon an orphanage for girls, and then a series of orphanages around neighboring towns, and then a pastor's college. Now, what a presumption this, never himself having gone to college to teach, to presume to teach young men to go out and preach in the basement room of the Metropolitan Tabernacle. Young men gathered and I lectured them and just told them what I was doing and what the Lord was doing. And I said, go and do thou likewise. And they went indeed over all the world to preach the gospel. I, who am speaking to you as myself and my wife had occasion some 9-10 years ago to speak in South Africa, and we found there two congregations which had been founded by students from Spurgeon's Pastor's College in the 19th century, still functioning. A pastor's college from whom men went, I say, around the world. In my congregation was a printer by trade who printed each week his pastor's sermon of the Lord's Day prior. And soon these became available for a penny in the country stores. And then by telegraph, they were available in New York City later in the week. And it became part of the shopping list for the housewife. Don't forget the Spurgeon, the Spurgeon. And my congregation member, Mr. Passmore, became a wealthy man publishing his pastor's sermons. Over 8,000 of them were published in the years that followed. And annually, they were collated into annual volumes of all the sermons of that year in what became called the Metropolitan Pulpit, named after the Metropolitan Tabernacle. I had two matched black horses which drew my cab, and they took me wherever I went. I was not a little proud of those two horses. It was a failing of mine, but they were beautiful horses. They were so unique that unique is not subject to comparison. They were unique in that they were borrowed by the Archbishop of Canterbury for state occasions. And he borrowed them from a preacher whom he would not otherwise have anything to do with. I was once criticized very boldly for working these horses so hard on the Lord's Day. And I replied, "Ah, but you see, these are Jewish horses. They rest on the Sabbath." See? God was pleased to bless and honor a life of labor, which in the fading months of 1892, in my 58th year, were beginning to draw to a close. I preached my last sermon in my pulpit on June 7th of 1891. Was not able to continue physically. Was ordered by my physician to Mentone, to France, for recovery. Early, to take advantage of my weakness and the sunny climate. And on this occasion only, her doctor permitted Susie to go with me. Susie, who had assisted me in ways beyond recall, who read to me, I was capable of reading myself, but who read to me, who helped me, who became a companion of rare worth, who on one occasion when I was having difficulty developing an outline of a text, it had been my practice to prepare a sermon within hours of its delivery. I wanted it to be fresh. The day before, I would seek a text, and I would, having found it, work on an outline, and having decided it, go to bed and sleep, and the next day preach it. This was regular occurrence, but on one occasion it had not been successful. I had a text, but I did not have an outline, and I was fearful, and it was Saturday evening, and Susie said to me, "Tirshatha, go to bed early. I'll waken you early in the morning, and with a fresh mind, the outline will come." Hesitantly, but trusting her word, I retired early. Susie was wakened in the night hearing her husband preach the text that he had been seeking. In his sleep, she did not waken me. She took her bed pad and wrote on it the outline as I preached it, laid it aside, woke me not at an early hour, but at my usual hour, and I awoke with consternation when I realized what had happened. I didn't realize what had happened. And she said, as she gave me the pad, "Here, Tirshatha, preach it again." This was a sample of her ministry to me. I say she was permitted by her doctor to join me for the first and only time on my journey to Mentone. I think the doctor sensed it might be the last such trip. It indeed was. And the fall passed, and by January of 1892, on an hour before midnight, having been visited by Hudson Taylor, and at different times, David Livingston. David Livingston once said to me, "Mr. Spurgeon, how do you do the work of two men?" And I replied, "Ah, but you see, there are two of us, and she whom you see least does most of the work. I must tell you that Susie, with her malady and her difficulty, and I once sat before the fireplace and heard the logs burning." I say, heard the logs burning. You know what I'm talking about? The sparkling and the crackling and the whistling as gases were being released, and the beautiful song of the bird almost in the burning. And I said, "Susie, it's just like you, isn't it? How the heat of the fire releases the song of the bird." She had gone through much pain and suffering, and yet there was rejoicing and singing. Well, an hour before midnight on the 19th of January, I passed from this life into a better. There was a brief memorial service there in a French Protestant church, a French Reformed church. And my body was taken to London, where it lay before my pulpit as 60,000 people came by to bid Charlie goodbye one last time. Alexander McLaren and another good man spoke at the funeral. Ira Sankey, who often had been in my church with Dwight Moody, sang. The body was carried on a cart drawn by my two black horses. On the casket was an open Bible to that text, "Look unto me and be ye saved, all ye ends of the earth, for I am God and there is none else." Norwood Cemetery became my earthly resting place. Under a stone inscribed as I had desired, "Here lies the body of C.H. Spurgeon, awaiting the coming of his Lord and Savior." And under that, this stanza. Ere since by faith I saw the stream thy flowing wounds supply, redeeming love has been my theme and shall be till I die. And had been, by the grace of God, only a man, a simple man, some would say an uneducated man, how little did they know, but a man whom God used. And the theme of my text is God uses human instruments to accomplish divine purpose. God uses men and women. He uses you and me. To him be praise.